both are seen in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so glad that we can begin today's morning show with Carlo Nevacossi. That will be a very familiar name to any of you who have listened to the morning show faithfully over the last year and a half or so. Carlo Nevacossi has joined us on a number of occasions to talk about COVID as it has played out in Walworth County, where he is now director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. And we are reconnecting with Carlo Nevacossi to try to get a sense of where the COVID numbers are going in Walworth County at the moment, and also to get his understanding of kind of the situation with vaccinations and a recent announcement, which allows for a third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine for certain people who are immunocompromised. And we'll get from him some clarification on some of the statistics that can be accessed if one visits the website of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. So there's a lot to get to. Carlo Nevacossi, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Gregory. Thank you for having me again.
Well, and I so appreciate you making time in what I know is a very, very busy schedule. I also wanted to make it clear that we are actually recording this interview Monday morning, Monday the 16th of August. And so the data that we will be talking about will be in terms of what is available at this moment as we are speaking. And, of course, a few days from now, when people are actually hearing this interview, some of those numbers will have changed. In fact, do I remember that on Thursday, that is typically a day in which a certain amount of new numbers come in?
Thursday it tends to be when we report out, although that's a good thing to note here, in that the data that we're gauging how we're handling the virus is coming from the CDC now, and they update daily, in fact. So we've started to link to that, which, you know, may eventually complicate things, as it's possible that we may be moving within a week between moderate, substantial, and high transmission. It makes communication and planning a little bit difficult, but certainly the data is in a much different place at this phase of the pandemic than it was, you know, say 12 months ago or 15 months ago, when we were really struggling to find good numbers.
Hmm. So before we dig into a few specifics, can I ask you, I mean, this might seem like a overly simplistic question, but how do you feel right now about the situation with COVID in Walworth County?
Right. I feel very, very much two ways. We have done, as a county and as a community, an excellent job of getting vaccine to our vulnerable. Very acceptable rates, of course. I love 100% of our vulnerable to get a vaccine, but that's a little unrealistic. But we've done very well, and so we've seen our death rate drop dramatically. which is great. The other side of it is that looking at the county as a whole, we're vaccinated at a lower rate than many other counties. Looking at my numbers here today, I think we're at about 45% of Walworth County residents with one dose, and only about 40% with the full series. So while on one hand we were successful in delivering it to the most vulnerable and preventing death and serious illness largely, the virus continues to spread. That's not great. Just admit it. It disrupts life. Our hospitals are doing well. My numbers here today say, maybe four people in the hospital right now between our two major hospitals. About 88 cases active in the county right now. Hmm. As of Monday, again Thursday, the data will likely be updated and changed. So it's disheartening. We were at a point early this summer where we really thought that we had our heads above water, Delta emerged. Although I will say Delta and its impact on Walworth County is largely speculative. The samples, the state decides some random sampling to test for Delta. So I don't have good data on how much of the transmission is specifically Delta versus standard. I can speculate that it's probably significant, but I don't know that for certain.
Right, and I did wanted to ask you about that because as I moved through your website, I did not see anything that seemed to indicate any specific numbers of cases related to the Delta variant. So
right, we don't have them.
So let me ask you about a couple of things, just so a listener who visits your website might also better understand some of the things that are there. Although I do want to say at the outset, I really appreciate how clearly laid out your website is, and the wealth of information there is really impressive. But it's also not so much information that one feels completely overwhelmed. So I really feel like it's nicely designed with regular folks like me in mind. So one of the most basic statistics we see, and again, this is as of Monday the 16th that we're talking, in Walworth County, total confirmed cases, 9,849. Right below that, recovered confirmed cases, 9,589. So that would is that as simple a thing as the number of people who have confirmed cases and have recovered?
Versus those that have passed away, correct.
So if we just did some subtraction, then that tells us what we're talking about then.
Yes. Again, my numbers from late last week. I have 169 deaths in the county attributed to COVID over the duration of the pandemic, and I think that was a number that was far more important, still important to report, but very important earlier on in the pandemic. Again, when information wasn't readily available and people were, rightly scared. We wanted to demonstrate that we've had hundreds and now thousands of cases in Walworth County, and the vast, vast majority, overwhelming majority of people that contract COVID are recovering. That's holding true now as we're seeing this newer wave of transmission, which, again, the numbers are up over where they were in June, but we're certainly not at the levels that we were in, say, November, December, and January, when we were really, really underwater with, up to 100 new cases a day.
Right. It kind of makes me a little sick to my stomach just kind of thinking about how all of this was playing out then. I mean, how frightening it was.
Right.
And while there's certainly plenty of reason to still be concerned, we are not where we were then. A little bit later in that part of the website is a statistic, just over 3,000 total probable cases. So would that be then cases in which someone perhaps had COVID, but we're not certain, or does that statistic mean something else?
It would be, say, a family member that was identified or a close contact identified during a contact investigation, contact tracing, that became symptomatic but ultimately didn't test. We make an assumption if you're the easiest example is a household member. If you're a married couple and a spouse tests positive and the other is symptomatic but doesn't test, those are at times considered probable cases.
Right.
So we think the evidence is so strong that it's COVID that the test isn't all that helpful or necessary.
Interesting. Very good.
But we still want to capture those as cases.
Right. One of the things that really astonished me was in a portion of the website in which we see the cases of, I would assume, confirmed cases of COVID broken down by age. And there we see, and by a fairly significant margin, again, if I was reading this bar graph correctly, that the most number of cases of COVID were in people in their 20s.
Yes.
Can you talk further about that kind of breakdown of ages and what that suggests?
Sure. What I believe it suggests, just as is we have a group of people that view themselves as at lower risk of serious illness. That's been the case for much of the pandemic, and less likely to kind of embrace social distancing, and more likely to gather. I mean, we have a university in our county with 15,000 of those of people falling into that age range. So I think it just speaks largely to where this group is, how they have viewed the virus historically, and. To some extent, in terms of their own health, they're right, and that's not a group that we have seen, that we've treated in the hospital, or that we've been concerned about a lot of deaths with. We're just, again, more concerned with community transmission at that point.
Right.
Although I know the unit. Oh, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, sorry. Because I'm just going to say, because they themselves are not falling seriously ill, does not mean that they aren't going to, in a sense, spread the virus to somebody who very likely might become seriously ill, perhaps even succumb altogether to COVID.
That is a concern.
Right.
It is. We've had UW Whitewater has been a good partner with us, with Rock County and Jefferson County throughout this, and looking at supporting them as they've got their students moving back on campus. We've got a move-in day vaccine clinic scheduled with UW Whitewater on August 31st. So it's a group we're paying attention to. Again, we've got a good partner in UW Whitewater that really is trying to, I think, incentivize students to get the vaccine. The UW system as a whole, I believe, is trying to incentivize students to do it. So we're going to be there with them, having vaccine at the ready.
Very good. There is a chart close to this, what I was just discussing, a chart of total deaths broken down by age versus cases broken down by age, and this does confirm what you were just saying, that in fact young people very, very rarely die from COVID. On the chart I saw, it was a single one solitary person in their 20s in Walworth County has died of COVID. Only one person in their 30s has died of COVID, and of course the numbers creep upward as people get older. We should again underscore that just because you are younger and in robust health does not mean you should not be taking COVID-19 seriously.
Correct. It is the message being yes, and right, you are not at serious risk of illness or death, but you can pose a risk to those that are more vulnerable. That is certainly the message that we're trying to convey moving forward too. You're right about the data though. That's one thing that's held true throughout this, is that we have a pretty good handle on who this impacts the greatest. Our data backs that up. It's people that are older, and it's people that have other serious health conditions. Those are the people that are at risk. So again, I go, when I talked earlier about feeling two ways about this, about where we're at with things, I'm very encouraged by how that group, our older adults, have embraced the vaccine and just said, hey, we're going to do this. This is a matter of our own health. We're going to take what we can into our own hands and protect ourselves. And, we haven't had much in the way of concerns around adverse reactions and things like that. We've given, thousands and thousands of shots at this point. So for that group, this has worked. It's kept them out of hospitals, kept our hospitals clear, kept that group healthy and really safe.
Very good. I do want to return just for a moment to the Delta variant, and again, we've already touched on the fact that in terms of the statistics that you have available to you, you have no way of knowing how much we're seeing in terms of the Delta variant, although your suspicions are that that a significant number of the current cases are tied to this Delta variant. My understanding is that the danger of the Delta variant is that it is more easily transmissible than the original COVID-19 virus. I have not read anything that would indicate that it tends to make people more ill, more seriously ill, that it you don't contract more severe symptoms if you contract the Delta variant. Am I correct about that, or is that still not fully understood?
That's my understanding as well. And this is we continue to learn a little bit every week, I think, about the virus. But you're spot on. It's really about the transmissibility. Highly, highly transmissible. Not necessarily more deadly or leading to more symptomatic, more severe illness, but highly transmissible. At the same time, the vaccines seem to be working on preventing serious illness and death with Delta, with really any of the variants that we've seen so far. So you're right. Highly transmissible, not necessarily tied to more serious illness or death.
One other statistical point I want to get clarification from you on is when I visited the website this morning, one of the first things that came up on the, I think you call it the dashboard, right?
Yes, where our community data dashboard.
Right. One of the top items there was something about the 14-day percent positivity.
Yes.
And at the moment, it was a positive of 6.8% or something, and a negative, yes, of just over 90%.
Yes.
Can you unlock those numbers for us? What do those numbers say, and how significant are those numbers?
Well, they're significant in that that's a number that CDC uses to gauge the significance of our transmission rates. And so 6.87% is higher than 5% has long been held as kind of the benchmark you want to stay below. So the rate is 6.87%, which means that of all of the people that are receiving COVID tests for any reason, whether it's a pre-op before a surgery or it's they're symptomatic or they're a household member, 6.87% of those that are testing positive. Now, I will say at the same time, it doesn't tell the full story because the rates at which people are seeking COVID testing has dropped dramatically too. Remember the days last summer of, our public testing sites with the Wisconsin National Guard, and we would, have hundreds and even, peaked over 1,000 tests, over the course of a testing engagement. And again, I think that speaks to people being scared and not really knowing, with the vaccine not being widely available and people being concerned about, the what if. Those numbers were probably a more accurate reflection of our true positivity rate because so many people were testing, whether they were symptomatic or asymptomatic. It's likely, I believe now, that the people that are getting tested, like I said, are the people that are preparing for a medical procedure that the hospital is requiring, people that might be going on a trip and want to have some sort of proof of a negative test. So I'm not sure how accurate that number is. I think the better number is the confirmed positives, and then the hospitalization data continues to be a key piece of data that I look at. And like I said, we've got four people in the hospital now that again tells me that the virus may be spreading, which is not good because it's disrupting. And at the same time, the people that are vulnerable are largely protected at this point.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Carlo Nevacozzi, who is director of Walworth County's Department of Health and Human Services. And we are making our way through the Walworth County Health Department's community dashboard, which includes perpetually updated statistics regarding COVID-19 as it is impacting the citizens of Walworth County. I was noticing, by the way, at another portion of the website, Walworth County's total population is 103,868. So that's the total populace that we are talking about. Let's circle back to the matter of vaccines.
Sure.
And to the fact that we're looking at a just under 45% of the residents of Walworth County have received at least one dose. Just under 40% are completely vaccinated. Now, I would assume that those percentages are not about the adult population, but rather the total population, or is that a percent of absolutely everybody in the county?
That is everybody. At
okay.
Point.
So it would be impossible to be at 100% because of all of the children for whom the vaccine is currently not available, correct?
Correct. So, yeah, barring any sort of approval, you know, by the FDA for use with younger children, we would not be able to get 100%. No.
Right. So,
well, and I think there's still a portion of the public that for health reasons, medical reasons, can't either. So we know that. We expect that, too.
Right, exactly. But, of course, that percentage, which you do wish was higher, that is of people who are completely vaccinated and could be, that, of course, the fact that we're not where we want to be means that we're talking about a certain number of people that are vaccine hesitant for one reason or another, and then also a certain portion of the population that are actually vaccine resistant or vaccine hostile. I've seen that term as well. Can you just say a quick word about the public health department's strategy in terms of thinking about these two different types of people that are not vaccinated at the moment?
Right. I think you're right. People do fall into several of these groups. You know, you've got the early adopters who are first in line to get a vaccine. You've got those on the other side who really maintain that they don't want it, they don't need it. And changing those minds is a long process. It's something we're trying to do, but one strategy that we've employed throughout the pandemic that I'm proud of with Walworth County's Health Department is we've tried to meet people where they're at with how they feel, how they think about the virus, and not taking in your face or a shaming kind of approach, but one of more of an educational approach. And we know that we've gotten through that large group that wanted the vaccine. We had our large vaccine clinics. We had, you know, again, thousands of people coming through our doors to get one. And now our strategies have changed because what we're targeting now is we're kind of working our way back into that group is those that are hesitant or those that would get a vaccine if it was convenient. And so we're trying to make it now as convenient as possible. We're blessed. Our county board approved the purchase this summer of a mobile health clinic. We call it our mobile health hub. One of the uses, of which there are many, is that we've been able to use it to take vaccine directly into the community. We've been at farmers markets, we've been at festivals, we've been at school orientation meetings. So really anywhere people gather, we've been able to just be there, have our doors open, and kind of catch some of that walk-by traffic. Again, for people who, for whatever reason, haven't, maybe they're hesitant, or maybe it's been difficult for them to find time to get one, we're there, and we're not in their face. But we're there if they want us.
Right.
That's, you know, you'll see us at the fair in a few weeks, too. We'll be doing any number of health and human services related activities and information giving. But we will have some vaccine available as well.
And has that yielded some level of success, at least from time to time?
It has. I think more than, I don't have the numbers directly in front of me, but we had pretty conservative estimates around how many vaccines we would give with some of these events, and it's exceeded our projections.
Very good.
And the public has been very kind to us too, which is nice. That you know, there is with you know, how strongly people's opinions are about this. I think we thought that there may be some risk of pushback, but I think given our approach, just again being a partner, being an educator, and not being someone that's going to try shame or some other tactics to get people to take a vaccine, I think that's worked certainly in our favor.
Very good. So this announcement has recently been made that certain immunocompromised individuals are eligible to seek out and receive a third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Can you tell us more about that and what segment of the population we're talking about?
Oh, goodness. You hit me with a tough one here.
Uh-oh.
No, I'm just unpacking some of this myself, since it hasn't, we haven't offered, ourselves haven't offered vaccines to that group yet.
Well, and I should.
Process of preparing. So I think
sure.
What you said, immunocompromised, we're back to that original group where we know that there's comorbidities, there's medical conditions that really put them at increased risk of serious illness or death from COVID. While I don't have a lot of information around where these folks can go, I would encourage them. This is an issue probably to take up with their primary care physician. I would anticipate that we will at some point be offering booster doses for that group and you know, for other groups as FDA approval or as CDC guidance changes around the vaccine.
Right. And I should also underscore that as we are speaking, this announcement has really just been made. I mean, so you and your counterparts are understandably in a situation right now of just kind of sorting through the specifics of that. As for the matter of younger people, at the moment, what is the youngest person that can receive the COVID-19 vaccine at this point?
Right. We're at 12 years old. The Pfizer vaccine is approved, while the emergency use extends to down to 12 years old.
Okay. So do you have any sense of when we will be seeing a vaccine for children younger than 12? I mean, I'm not asking for... I guess I'm just asking more for kind of a gut sense that you might have in terms of how long does it typically take, or maybe that's even a kind of out of order question in the sense that we've never been in exactly this situation before. We've contended with other public health crises, but maybe none that have exactly resembled COVID-19. But I mean, how long a gauntlet and how complicated a gauntlet is it to take a vaccine that is safe for adults and figure out how to make it safe for children?
Sure. In terms of things, these being unprecedented times, I think we're trying to retire that term, but it still is fitting. Just the process by which vaccine has been brought to the public has already been accelerated, you know, beyond any vaccine development effort, given how effective it is for adults. And how COVID continues to really, you know, in terms of serious illness and death, leave our kids alone for the most part, I would expect it to take significantly more time than it's taken adults to come to the table. Again, keeping in mind we don't even have full FDA approval for any of our vaccines, I would expect that to happen next. I believe we'll have approval for at least one of them sometime this fall. So I would not expect a vaccine for younger children in any time in the immediate future. Now, I could be wrong, but that's my sense right now. Full FDA approval of you know, one or more of the vaccines before the year is over, before we see any additional.
Right, and I'm glad you underscored the fact that the development of the vaccine that we adults are accessing, I mean, it's incredible how quickly that became available, and of course more than one. I mean, because you know there were certain sober predictions that we might be looking at 3 or 4 years, and the fact that we had two safe vaccines so quickly is really an amazing feat that should not be forgotten.
Right, I do think approval, which I believe is inevitable, although I'm not sure for which vaccine or with how many, but I think for some of our folks that are still hesitant, I think that may be a piece of information that pushes them into the vaccine acceptance category. I think back to what happened with Johnson & Johnson and how it was paused, and I really do believe that caused a lot of people to change their mind about whether or not they were going to get vaccinated. So I think that would be a positive step for us. I'm looking forward to that.
Right. I recently saw statistics, not on your County Health Department website, but elsewhere, that tried to make very, very clear where we are seeing people die from COVID. And it is a tiny percentage of COVID deaths that are among those who have received a vaccine, which in effect makes the current pandemic a pandemic among the unvaccinated. Do you think the statistics are convincing on that front?
Oh yes, I think that's an accurate description of where we're at, and right, it's some things up nicely, and those that are in Walworth County that are unvaccinated are tending to be low risk too. So it's still a group that that's not showing up in our hospitals, although they are potentially spreading it. But we're seeing some. We're able to predict a little bit better about what's going to happen. So I think, again, from a hospital capacity standpoint, we're in good shape. From an ongoing transmission of the virus, we're not doing as good.
Right. So at the moment, if I understand correctly, in Walworth County, I think the number I saw first thing this morning, Monday morning, was 88 active confirmed cases.
Correct.
Correct. And, of course, as we see certain charts, we see that up. So at the moment, Walworth County is in kind of an upward trend in terms of number of cases?
Yes, we are. I guess one of the exciting things about the pandemic is it's given us an opportunity to recruit some new staff with some very specific technical expertise. We have an epidemiologist now who is working on our Walworth County numbers and thinks that we may continue to see cases increase until September. So there's some sense that 15 or 16 months, like it was the first time around, it really feels like deja vu. But what we're seeing now is not the same as what we saw this past winter.
Right. Two more quick questions, and I'll let you get back. How difficult has it been for you and your colleagues to attend to other matters that would normally be a little more kind of front and center in terms of your obligations and responsibilities? How much has COVID-19 made difficult or maybe even impossible for you to attend to some of these other issues that have no direct relationship to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Incredibly challenging in the public health area. When our health department does a lot of things that are not COVID. We're talking about lead testing, well testing, early child home visiting programs, women, infant, and children's programming, birth to three, and so many things. Many of them were really taken offline during the pandemic when we shifted to really full COVID response for our health department, which even included people from other areas of health and human services who were pulled over into public health to do things like contact tracing. On the other hand, though, I think this agency did remarkably well making sure that there were no disruptions in service. We did increase some remote work. However, we had staff in the building. The building never closed. We had staff here. We've got programs that needed to continue to run, and we found a way to do them. I believe that there are some state agencies, for example, who continue to be remote. We've been back in the office almost 100% for months now. So I believe that our employees and our services are essential, and they have continued throughout the pandemic, again, with the exception of some public health services when all of those public health resources were dedicated to COVID response.
Hmm. Finally, explain this phone number 211.
211, boy, 211 has been around for a long time. They serve the entire state. And it's really a kind of a clearinghouse for information. Really, if you need anything, 211 is a good place to start. If we're talking about concrete resources, things like food or benefit assistance, 211's been helpful during the pandemic as well, and has served as a resource to try to take some of the pressure off the county health departments and handle some COVID information for the public. So it's a place where the public can call and ask questions about COVID as well.
Very good. And again, I want to restate that I found the wealth of information on the Walworth County Public Health Department's website to be really impressive, both in terms of its scope and also in its clarity. And I would really encourage anybody who has not done so to visit the dashboard of Walworth County's Public Health Department. And, of course, Racine County and Kenosha County have their own websites with which I'm a little less acquainted. But you'll find all kinds of information that will be of value to you. Carla Nevakosi, Director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services, I really appreciate you making time for this conversation and commend you and all of your colleagues for the great work you are doing in these challenging times. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Thank you again for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. It's not every day that I get to say that I am speaking today on The Morning Show with ABC's Dan Harris. And in fact, I feel very privileged to be able to say that for the second time, I am speaking with ABC's Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America, and a very, very highly regarded television journalist who also has generated some headlines because of the candid and open memoir that he has written called 10% Happier, which became a number one New York Times bestseller, in which he told his story of trying to come to terms with some mental and emotional demons. And it was through meditation, of all things, that he was able to really find himself into a healthier and more whole place. And he has written a new book, an audiobook called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, in which he delves further into meditation and what a difference it has made in his life. And I'm very honored indeed to be able to reconnect with Dan Harris to talk with him about his newest book. Dan Harris, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Especially for the sake of any listeners who missed our first conversation or for whatever reason don't know your full story, I think it's important for us to lay some groundwork here. Spell out, please, for our listeners, the kind of darkness that was behind what seemed like a very happy outward facade that the world was seeing.
Yeah, you laid it out beautifully, and I'll just elaborate on it. So I wrote a first book in 4 years ago called 10% Happier. That was kind of a memoir about how a skeptical, hard-charging newsman came to embrace something that he always thought was ridiculous, which was meditation. And the story there is that I had a panic attack rather inconveniently on national television on Good Morning America back in 2004. I was reading the news headlines that morning. I was the guy who came on and did the quick wrap-up of the day's news. And in the middle of it, my heart started racing, my lungs seized up, my mouth dried up, my palms were sweating. I just couldn't talk anymore, and I had to quit and throw it back to the main host of the show. And that was very embarrassing. And even more embarrassing is what caused it. What caused it is that I spent many years in war zones as an ambitious young reporter, and I came home from that experience and got depressed. This is after 9/11, and I did a very dumb thing, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine. And even though my drug career was kind of short and rather intermittent, I was never using drugs when I was on the air or working or anything like that. After the panic attack, a doctor informed me that the drug use was enough to artificially alter my brain chemistry and make it more likely for me to freak out. And so that was a very humbling moment, and that's what set me off on the weird and windy journey that ultimately led to me embracing meditation. And what really changed my mind about the practice is that there's a lot of science that suggests it's really good for you, that it can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, help with anxiety and depression, and literally rewire key parts of your brain. And so that allowed me to get started, and And then a couple years later, I wrote, after I wrote 10% Happier, I wrote a book more recently called Meditation for 50D Skeptics. And it's available as a regular book, but also as an audio book, which I recorded myself along with my co-author, who's a meditation teacher.
The title of the book, of course, implies that it is conceived especially for skeptics of meditation. And this is as good a time as any to add that you would be among the kings of skeptics, I mean, when it comes to meditation. Explain to our listeners just how unlikely a candidate for meditation you were, or in a sense, what an odd match it was for you and meditation to find one another.
It's a deeply odd match, no question about it. I'm a paid skeptic. You know, this is my job as a journalist. And I was raised by a pair of ex-hippies, and I grew up to hate everything that reeked of anything hippie-ish. So I was under the assumption that meditation was for people who live in a yurt and are really into Enya and collect crystals and that kind of thing. And what ultimately changed my mind, as I mentioned before, is one was the science. Again, that was very intriguing to me, especially as somebody who has suffered with anxiety and depression. That was very intriguing. And the other is that meditation does not involve, the other thing I learned that really got me to do it, was that meditation doesn't involve a lot of the things I worried that it might. You know, you don't have to sit in a funny position. You don't have to believe in anything. You don't have to clear your mind magically or anything like that. That's impossible just to stop thinking. Meditation is simple, secular exercise for your brain. And let me just talk about the clear your mind thing for a second, because a lot of people, you know, suffer under this misconception that they can't meditate because they can't stop thinking. But the goal of meditation is not to stop thinking, because that's impossible. The goal of meditation is just to focus your mind just for a few nanoseconds at a time, usually on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. So you sit in a reasonably quiet place, close your eyes, try to feel your breath coming in and going out. And as soon as you try to do this, your mind will go into full-on mutiny mode. You'll have all sorts of random thoughts. And the goal is just to notice when you become distracted and to start again and again and again. And that moment of noticing you become distracted is a victory. It's not a failure. It's a victory, because when you see how crazy you are, the craziness has less of a chance of owning you.
Explain to our listeners how this book is put together by you and your co-author, Jeff Warren. It is something of a tour in which we are not only exploring meditation through your own eyes, but through the eyes of quite a few different people, quite a wide array of people, in fact, for whom it has really made a difference.
Yeah, the backstory behind the book is yet again me being dumb. I kind of unwisely assumed, you know, when I wrote 10% Happier 4 years ago, when I published it 4 years ago, I didn't know if anybody was going to read it, but I did kind of assume that anybody who did read it would magically hurl themselves into the lotus position and start becoming a meditator. That is pretty dumb, because it was way underestimates how difficult it is to establish a healthy habit. We're not, you know, we were not wired by evolution to create healthy habits. Evolution didn't really care about your long-term health. It just cared about getting your evolution doesn't really care about flossing, for example. So, you know, creating healthy habits is hard. And so what I decided to do with this book is to do a cross-country road trip in a big, silly orange bus with 10% Happier decals on the side. I recruited an amazing meditation teacher named Jeff Warren, who's actually Canadian, but we can forgive him for that. And, I'm kidding. I love Canadians. Jeff and I went across this country, the United States, and we met all sorts of people, like social workers and celebrities and cops and politicians, all sorts of people who are interested in meditation but aren't doing it. And we helped them. We identified the primary obstacles, and we systematically tackled them and helped people get over the hump. One of the big obstacles is, you know, I can't clear my mind. We've talked about that. Another big obstacle is, you know, I don't have time for this. So we, you know, there are others like, you know, this is going to make me soft in my career, or people are going to think I'm weird, or somehow this is self-indulgent. And we, one by one, we go through them and we help you get over them.
Right. It's interesting, because I think you're saying a couple of different things. One of them is that we have to sort of break ourselves loose of our preconceptions about what meditation is and the kind of person who is likely to enjoy it and or benefit from it. But the other thing is that meditation itself is in a sense a much more adaptable kind of thing. It isn't just one thing, one kind of practice that everybody has to figure out a way to do the same way. But in fact, it can, in a sense, fit just about anybody and just about anybody's life circumstances.
Jeff Warren, my co-author on this book, I refer to him often as the meditation MacGyver, because he is really good at coming up with ways to meditate that fit you. And so one of the things he does is really help you turn everyday activities like brushing your teeth, walking between meetings, putting your kid to bed, and especially that's been very useful for my wife because we have a toddler and she's usually on putting the kid to bed duty. And so he helps you turn all of these often in between moments into brain exercise that can ripple out into the rest of your life and make you calmer and easier to live with.
In fact, you're touching on an interesting fact here, which is that for some people, at least, they probably already engage in some meditation or almost are and just don't realize it. And that in many cases, this is not about carving out time to do something you've never done before, but maybe just doing some of the things you're already doing in just a slightly different way. So it can become, in a sense, a more meditative activity.
That is exactly right. Look, I think let me just add on, let me build on that, which is to say that we're always training our brains. Everything you do trains your brain in some way, you know? Like, so if you spend a lot of time sending hatred towards some political figure you don't like or some, you know, neighbor you don't like, then your brain's going to get better at hating. And actually, while I don't recommend hating, this does to a very positive thing, which is that the brain and the mind are trainable, that we think we are a certain way. We have a certain level of happiness. We have a certain level of generosity, calm, patience. And that's the way we always are. These are factory settings that can't be tinkered with. But in fact, happiness, generosity, compassion, all the mental states that we want, these are skills that are trainable. And meditation is one of the ways to train these important skills.
Hmm. The book, again, is called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, and it is by ABC's Dan Harris, co-authored by a meditation teacher, Jeff Warren. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau, and again, it is available not only in print, but also in an audiobook recorded by Dan Harris himself. Dan Harris, thank you so much for this newest book and for all that you are doing to help people, and we wish you the very, very best in all that is ahead for you, and thanks for being part of The Morning Show once again.
Yeah, thank you for having me back on, and thank you for your wonderful questions. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we preview for you the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival, one of the happiest summertime events here in southeastern Wisconsin, on hiatus last summer because of COVID-19, but back this year. And I'm going to be speaking with two of the musical headliners of this year's festival, pianist Alex Bunyol and saxophonist Marion Meadows. We've recorded a wonderful interview yesterday that you'll be hearing, along with examples of their fabulous music making. That will be tomorrow on The Morning Show, right here on WGTD. Over the weekend, in the podcast version of the program, you can hear my interview with Susan Jane Gilman talking about her exciting and colorful memoir called Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven, which talks about some of the amazing experiences she had as a young person visiting the nation of China. It's exactly 9 o'clock. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You can find the program archived on our website, WGTD.org. If you're interested in subscribing to The Morning Show podcast, be sure to look for it under the proper title, The Morning Show.